As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for an HPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. This week, calls for teachers to get vaccinated sooner grew louder. Lawmakers held hearings on bills addressing public access to police records and disciplinary hearings. Attorney General Gordon McDonald was considered once again for a seat on the state Supreme Court. And, of course, we got a new president and vice president. It has been a busy week in the news, and we'd love to hear from you about it, especially if you have questions about where teachers should fall in line for vaccines. Call us now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also tweet at us at NHPR Exchange or send us an email. That's an easy way to reach us. Just send it to exchange@nhpr.org. Lots to talk about today, and let's turn first to Megan Tuttle, president of the National Education Association of New Hampshire. That's the state's largest teachers union. Megan Tuttle, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a clip from Governor Sununu speaking yesterday at his press conference. He spoke quite a bit about schools and vaccines, and he said that the goal of the state right now, with the limited number of vaccine doses that it has, is to stop as many fatalities as it can, and that means prioritizing elderly folks. And he also talked about schools being prepared for the coming few months, being prepared to open, and he says schools can, in fact, open now.
Schools, I think, can open today, but even if they're not open today, start thinking about how you're going to open, how you're going to ramp up. It might not be next week, but it's not necessarily in June either. So they have to start planning ahead, and we have to start, again, just understanding the models of success that are out there. And my frustration really drives on that comment I kept hearing. Teachers have to be vaccinated for schools to open. That is 100% false.
I want to ask you about that last part, Megan Tuttle. Does that accurately describe your views that schools, teachers need to be vaccinated for schools to open?
You know, educators should be vaccinated before the schools can reopen safely. He mentioned that, you know, we should start planning for schools to be open. We've been planning for schools to be opening safely and advocating for it since last summer. So we've been planning for this. The fact that educators in New Hampshire, one of the only states in the country to have their educators vaccinated in phase two instead of phase one, is just ridiculous. We should have been in phase one in the beginning, and all of this could have been avoided. We're not politicizing anything, but getting the educators in New Hampshire vaccinated is going to get the schools open quicker and safely.
The governor said that the average age of teachers in New Hampshire was 46. And so if you had it your way, the governor argues that tens of thousands of people who are well below the age of 65 and are therefore at less risk of dying of COVID-19 would get vaccines before people who are over the age of 65 who have more of a risk of dying of COVID-19. So my question to you is that fair? Is it fair for, say, a 37-year-old teacher to get a vaccine while an 80-year-old person in New Hampshire waits a little longer?
No, that's a great question. We've never said that anybody over 65 or with a pre-existing health condition, et cetera, shouldn't get vaccinated. What we're saying is that we have educators across the state. NEA New Hampshire represents about 17,000 educators. And yes, they're all different varying ages, but they're also part of their communities, and they're part of, you know, they have to quarantine if they have close contact from outside the school. And so we have thousands of educators across the state that do need to be vaccinated because they are such a crucial part of the community where they live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but why should someone who is, we'll say my age, 37, why should someone my age who has less of a risk of dying of COVID-19 be prioritized for a vaccine or be put in the same group as those who are 75 or 80 and have a greater risk of dying? Because with the limited number of vaccines we have, they have to go to someone. And the governor is prioritizing those who have a greater risk of dying. I guess what I'm asking is, why is that wrong?
Because we're considered essential workers. And if they want the schools to reopen and they want the communities to get back to normal and they want the economy in the communities to get back to what we were pre-COVID, we need to be vaccinating those essential workers. We're considered essential workers and we're considered first responders when it comes to school violence. When we have to learn how to tie tourniquets on kindergartners so that we can save lives when it comes to school violence, all of a sudden when it comes to vaccinations, education in New Hampshire is not being valued. It's not being prioritized. We're not saying that we need to skip over people, but when we found out that Ski Patrol was getting ahead in vaccinations more than educators in New Hampshire, that was a little discerning.
Why? Educators, I mean, because Ski Patrol people are considered EMTs, which, I mean, you just used the example of tying tourniquets. I mean, EMTs, Ski Patrol people, people who break bones on the mountain, they need EMTs. Why? So what's the issue there?
Skiing is a luxury activity at this point. The governor wants the schools open, which we don't have. We don't have the ability to close schools. That's something that the governor does. We can only point out when the conditions in schools are not safe.
Can I stop you there? Because I believe my understanding is that the governor didn't close schools. The governor leaves it up to local school districts to decide whether or not schools should adopt either a hybrid model or stay in person.
Correct, but that's not the local union's position. We cannot decide if a school closes or not. It is left up to the local, and that's what the governor decided to do. Mm-hmm. But it's not the teachers' unions, as he's saying, that are trying to close the school downs. We're not. We want the schools open more than anybody. And we've been offering safe plans to get them open. It really comes down to educators in New Hampshire are not being valued. We should have been in the first phase, just like every other state in the country. That's the CDC recommendations and the CDC guidelines that we're following.
Governor Sununu spoke yesterday on the fact that teachers are not the only group of workers who are calling to be vaccinated sooner. Let's listen to what he said yesterday.
We heard from airline pilots this week. We heard from appliance manufacturers this week. We've heard from everybody. And I get it. Everybody wants to be first in line. But it has to be based on health, mortality, and hospitalization. That's how we, you know, that's why we're in this whole mess. And that's by taking care of that first. That's how we're going to get out of it in a very effective way.
Megan Tuttle of the National Education Association, you mentioned briefly that teachers are essential workers and therefore should be moved up into a higher vaccination priority. Teachers aren't the only essential worker class out there. The example that many people toss around is grocery store workers, who one could argue have less of the ability to work remotely than teachers do. Where do you draw the line if we're starting to move essential workers into an earlier priority? Is it just teachers, or should all essential workers, including grocery store workers or those two that Governor Sununu just mentioned, be also moved in with teachers?
That's not really my call to make. I'm here advocating for the vaccination of the educators across New Hampshire. The issue here is that the governor wants the schools to reopen. We want them to reopen safely. And honestly, I don't think that's going to happen unless we can get the educators vaccinated. Educators and children in schools are not having a high transmission rate at this point. Part of that is because, you know, we don't have child-to-child transmission in schools. It's not necessarily adult-to-child transmission in schools. So yes, the numbers look low. What's happening is we're having educators and children having to quarantine because of close contact with other people, with spouses, with family, with other outside activities, et cetera. We had a substitute shortage before we went into this pandemic, and it's even worse now. So if we have educators that can't be going into the schools and actually teaching or, you know, doing the job that they have to do in the schools are going to stay shut. The buildings, that we're going to have remote learning. It goes back to hybrid, to remote, to hybrid. I see it with my own children. That's not the best way to educate children, and we know that. If the governor wants the schools to reopen, then we should have had the educators vaccinated early on in the process, and the schools could have been reopened much safer. We've asked to meet with him. We want to talk with him and work with him on this, but we haven't heard anything from him or his office.
And just a reminder, too, that we have also at NHPR invited Governor Sununu to come onto the exchange. We hope to have him on soon, working on a date for that. Listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on this conversation we're having now, give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk to Christina in Concord. Christina, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
So I'm calling based on the question you asked earlier that you posed, you know, why should a 37-year-old teacher get vaccinated?
I don't question the need to get vaccinated. I'm questioning, with a limited number of resources available, why should a 37-year-old teacher get a vaccine before, say, a 75 or an 80-year-old person who has more of a risk of dying? That was the question I posed.
Exactly, yes. So I happen to be 37 years old. I happen to be a teacher. I had to make a really hard decision over winter break to resign from my teaching position because I have a chronic illness that requires me to suppress my immune system monthly. And throughout the fall, I just felt a sense of terror all the time being at school. And I felt that, you know, the state wasn't supporting us as teachers. We were having to go through all of these different quarantines and surveying and wearing all of our PPE. And still the fact that we weren't put on the essential care worker level to be able to get vaccinated first just felt so disappointing to me.
Mm-hmm. And Christina, may I ask you a question about this? Because the governor has also prioritized people who are younger than 65 who have a medically vulnerable condition. I don't know if that has provided any comfort to you or enabled you to be part of this next phase. Are you willing to comment on that? I realize this is a public forum and I'm asking about medical information, but I didn't know if that was something that was relevant to you.
Yeah, sure. As far as I've been told by my doctor's office that I would have to have two medical conditions to be qualified mm-hmm. for the vaccine. So right now that doesn't include me.
Okay.
So I am somebody who would love to be back at work. I love working with my students, but I just don't feel safe.
Well, Christina, thank you very much for your comments. I want to put your thoughts to Megan Tuttle, who's still with us. Megan Tuttle, what do you make of Christina's comments?
I completely agree with her. I have educators all over the state, and I'm glad you called in. Thank you, Christina. I have educators all over the state that don't feel safe, even if they don't have the pre-existing conditions. I'm really worried that because of the lack of valuing education across New Hampshire and because of everything happening with the pandemic and the stress that's been put on educators and everybody, quite frankly, not just educators, there's going to be a big surge of people leaving the profession at the end of the year.
A big surge of people leaving the profession. That sounds like a scary proposition for schools throughout the state. I want to keep taking some calls here because we've got some listeners with some comments here. Let's talk to Jane in Manchester. Jane, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Peter. I just wanted to call in because I happen to be over 65 mm-hmm. and but not 70. But, I mean, I think the teachers are right, and I think you're harassing the witnesses, frankly. I might say so, because, I mean, like, I'm retired and my husband's retired and all my friends are retired and we stay home, and it's not a sacrifice. I mean, it's a sacrifice for me to stay home, and I certainly wish I could see my grandchildren, but nobody's making me go into a place where I might be exposed. And so I think it's really hypocritical to say that we hope that kids can go back to school, which I agree with, and then not give the teachers the opportunity to get vaccinated ahead of time. I mean, I think they are essential workers.
Well,
Jane. The person that had conditions.
Well, Jane, thank you very much. The governor used the example yesterday of, you know, an 80-year-old person at home waiting to have the all clear to even hug someone. But Jane, with the alternate perspective, is that someone of that age or older could stay and wait while a teacher doesn't have that luxury. So Megan Tuttle, and to her point about harassing the witness, I apologize if you feel that way. I have to put questions to you about your policies and your ideas. But what do you make of Jane's comments?
Thank you, Jane. Thank you for the comment. You know, I appreciate it more than you know. We have never said in our position at NEA New Hampshire and educators across the state has never been that we want to jump ahead of anyone 65 or older, the elderly, anybody with pre-existing conditions. We've never said that. So I thank you for your perspective on that. What really started this is when we found out Ski Patrol was going ahead of the thousands and thousands of educators across the state. And so that's where, you know, that's where this went. I just want to make it clear that we have never advocated for us to skip the line or to do anything like that above elderly or pre-existing people with pre-existing conditions.
Let's talk to Lisa in Peterborough. Lisa, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, good morning. My full name is Lisa Witt, and I am the superintendent of schools in the Monadnock Regional School District. And I wanted to call and echo Megan's comments. And, you know, as a superintendent, I've had a couple of situations where I have had so many employees, school employees that needed to quarantine due to close contact that we've had to shift to remote learning. And, you know, the governor has made it clear that he wants schools open. And nobody wants schools open more than educators, for sure, and parents. But he's shifted the blame to districts, in my view, by saying that schools need to dig deep to figure out how to make that happen. And I think yesterday in his press conference made a reference to, you know, bringing in substitutes, that there's money to pay substitutes. And Megan, you made the point that even before the pandemic, the availability of substitutes was scarce, and it's even more so now. So I'm not quite sure. And I would love to, you know, to talk to the governor as well to understand how to dig deep in this situation. And it's my position that the governor can dig deep and figure out a way to prioritize educators if his priority is to maintain that schools need to be open. And I also just want to real quick echo Megan's comments that we do not advocate for, you know, we don't. Even we're not trying to skip the line. I completely understand and support prioritizing for those with pre-existing conditions and those that may be more at risk. Mm-hmm. But if schools are to be open, we need to be able to ensure that we can safely staff them.
Well, Lisa, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Let's also talk to Adam from Nashua really quickly. Adam, our time is short, but you're on the air. Please do make your point.
Good morning. Just for transparency, my name is Adam Marku. I'm president of the Nashua Teachers Union. I talked to Ellen yesterday in hopes to come on and support Megan and others who have called in today. One of my concerns about where we are in the line for vaccinations is that we currently have teachers and staff in our buildings right now that are working with some of our most medically fragile intensive needs students who can't wear a mask, who can't socially distance, not because they're not trying to do the best they can. It's that at times they just don't understand why they have to wear a mask or why they can't hug their teacher or why they can't hold hands anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's heartbreaking to see that. And we're not, like everyone else has said, we're not asking to cut the line. We're not asking for people to be pushed back. We're asking to be put in an order where 48 other states have our colleagues listed,
mm-hmm.
And want to be part of that. We have teachers that have said, you give me the vaccine, I'm ready to go right now. To be fair, we have teachers and staff that are ready to go back right now, regardless of a vaccine. But if we offer this next layer of protection for our education staff, it's one step closer to getting our kids back in school and back to what will be a new normal for them.
Well, Adam, thank you very much for your comments. Our time is short, Megan Tuttle, but I did want to ask you about school funding, concerns about school funding. Schools expect to get less next year in part because of the way student population is calculated right now. The number of students on free and reduced lunch is part of that equation. What do you think lawmakers should do to prepare the state's schools for the long-term fallout of this pandemic?
Well, I think initially they should be setting aside some funds if they can to help with that. We know it's going to be coming up, so it's not like it's going to be a surprise. And I, you know, the whole school funding issue, but in New Hampshire has been a problem for so long. We just need to keep looking at how we're going to be solving that.
Megan Tuttle is president of the National Education Association of New Hampshire, the state's largest teachers union. Megan, thank you very much for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about some legislation having to do with public access to police records and disciplinary hearings. Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader and Anna Brown of Citizens Count will join us. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've been following these bills and have a question or comment about them, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-848-9222. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also tweet us at NHPR Exchange or send us an email. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're so glad to have you with us this morning. Today, we're speaking about the week's news, and with me now, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization promoting civic engagement. Anna, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, Peter.
And Kevin Landrigan, State House Bureau Chief for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Thank you for being here.
Happy Friday, Peter.
Happy Friday, indeed. Let's talk about some of what's been going on this week at the State House. But actually, before we do that, I do want to get your thoughts really quickly on the local response to the inauguration of the president and vice president. There was stepped up security here. Citizens also had their say in the public dialogue. What do you think? Can I start with you, Anna?
Sure. Well, I definitely think that, you know, Governor Sununu has set a tone early on. He acknowledged Biden's win early on. And I think the message he's put forward is really, we want to work with Biden as quickly as possible on the pandemic response. And so in the past few months, you haven't seen a lot of, you know, praising Biden, I wouldn't say, but he's made clear that he's on board. And I think he had a tweet shortly after the inauguration where he said, you know, hoping for the best, can't wait to start working with him. And then there was, you know, a lot of praise, of course, among New Hampshire's Democratic congressional delegation, which is not terribly surprising. And overall, you know, pretty quiet in New Hampshire, I would say. We didn't see any mass protests or anything like that, which honestly might be partly because this state did go to Biden. It proved to be not a Trump stronghold.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, Anna's points were all great as usual. I think we have to confess, right? I mean, this was an unusual, in many ways, virtual inauguration. As Ray Buckley, the longtime Democratic Party chairman, pointed out, this is the first inauguration for a Democratic president he hasn't visited, hasn't been at personally since Lyndon Johnson. It's not that the support for Biden was muted, it just wasn't, you couldn't hear it. You know, you couldn't see it on the ground in DC, but there's no question he's got a lot of support here. After a very big win in New Hampshire. I thought Governor Sununu made an interesting comment at the end of the briefing last week when I asked him about a Senate impeachment trial. He's not taken any position on that with regards to whether to have a trial to convict former President Donald Trump. But for the first time, he said, I'm not sure what it will accomplish. If you're trying to solve something that's really political, is that really the right thing to do right now? We've got a lot of work to do. And I think he speaks to, frankly, even a number of supporters of this new president, is that they do have a big agenda. We've got a Senate that's deadlocked right now at 50-50, and the majority and minority leaders can't agree on how to run the Senate. So, and he's got a number of cabinet people he wants to get through. So there are supporters of this president who really would like to push off the impeachment trial until later so that this new president could get some things done.
All right. Well, we'll pay close attention to the goings on in D.C. regarding impeachment. But let's turn now to the New Hampshire Senate Judiciary Committee, which took up some bills addressing police transparency and access to police records and disciplinary hearings this week. First, for a little bit of context, Kevin, the New Hampshire Supreme Court made a decision last year on this, on what's discoverable through the right to know law, I believe, and what is not. This may have provided some inspiration for legislation, particularly Senate Bill 39, I think it was. So what happened in the Supreme Court that inspired some of this legislation?
Well, it's something that's called the Lori List, or the exculpatory evidence schedule. And this is a secret list for decades of police officers who have disciplinary problems that are so significant that prosecutors have to reveal to defense lawyers that this officer is on this list and has had histories of credibility issues. So the Supreme Court ruled that list is no longer automatically secret. Now that has pushed this whole court case back to Superior Court. But This became an issue after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, when Governor Chris Sununu created the Law Enforcement Accountability Commission, and really charged him with coming up. And one of its charges was not only to beef up police training and community support for police and community outreach by police, but also to change this process for how misconduct complaints against police are handled. So we had these competing hearings this week. I covered almost every meeting of that commission last summer when it met over 3 months. Deputy Attorney General Jane Young did a tour de force in getting this very disparate group that was across the spectrum from the New Hampshire Association of Police Chiefs to Black Lives Matter to agree on 48 recommendations. But I think what we saw this week is what I saw at those commission meetings, which was, as I said, Young did a great job. But the fact is, all these people didn't agree exactly on how things should proceed. They came together as a commission on things they could agree with. Now we're going to fight over the details in the sausage factory of the legislature.
And would that be a partisan fight, especially regarding Senate Bill 39, which is, you know, I believe, Kevin, trying to limit access to police records under the Right to Know law?
Right. There are really two bills here that they talked about. The one you spoke of, Senate Bill 39, making personnel files, internal investigations, and pre-employment background information all exempt from Right to Know. Meanwhile, Senate Bill 41 goes from the other perspective, which says all disciplinary hearings against an officer shall be public unless a judge determines there's a, quote, compelling interest, unquote, to make some or all of that proceeding confidential. Now, what's interesting is that's not what the commission recommended. The commission recommended that there be an independent panel created to investigate and adjudicate all complaints against police. Now, those hearings, the commission recommended, should be confidential. But a summary of the report by the commission about any officer should be public. And the defense lawyers and someone who has brought a complaint against police should be able to go to a judge and say, for the purposes of that complaint being tried in court, I want to see the entire file. And you've got to, and judge, you can order it public. So really, as I said, what we're seeing in the sausage factory is interest groups on all sides are now going to the legislature to say, this is how I want it. I want a little better than what the commission got us, or this is what I wanted. I want a little more restrictive than the commission got it.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask Anna Brown about what supporters and opponents are saying. Anna, what are you hearing about these two pieces of legislation regarding police access to police records and police disciplinary hearings?
So when you look at SB 39, which is the bill that would exempt a lot of this information from Right to Know, part of the argument is that there was a court case that set up a balancing test where trial court judges have to decide, all right, the public's interest versus the privacy rights of the employees. And that's going to be decided on a case-by-case basis, is not terribly clear. So there is an argument, which Senator Sharon Carson, the sponsor, made that, all right, maybe this isn't exactly the right line, but we need to figure out where this line is drawn, because if you leave it up to the courts, that's going to be a lot more costly and confusing, and we need to have a system in place that public employees feel they can operate under. So that was one argument, you know, that was not even exactly about police misconduct so much as, all right, how are we going to do this practically? And then obviously on the other side is that we need to have more public disclosure. And so when you're looking at the other bill, SB 41, this deals specifically with disciplinary hearings before the Police Standards and Training Council. And one thing that does make New Hampshire different from other states is we do have a state council that's responsible for essentially licensing police officers. It's called certification, but you know, if you're a layperson trying to understand it, basically this council has to say, okay, you can be a police officer in this state. And it's not at the state level across the United States. New Hampshire is a little different in that way. But yeah, those hearings aren't public. So the idea is, all right, if you're deciding whether or not someone should be allowed to be a police officer in New Hampshire ever in the future, yeah, that, you know, I think that there's a public interest there in hearing it. One more interesting thing I wanted to note that I was reflecting on this week, both of these bills are sponsored by Republicans. So it's Senator Sharon Carson on one hand, and then Senator Harold French was doing SB 41 about making the hearings public. So I think it's just interesting to note that this issue has proved to not clearly fall on party lines, even though there is clear people on either side of the issue. If you're looking at, you know, the Association of Police Chiefs are probably advocating for more policy, whereas maybe Black Lives Matter is arguing for more openness.
So I guess what you're saying is, at least when you look at these two bills, the Republican Party is not necessarily responsible for the elimination of transparency when it comes to police misconduct.
Correct.
Okay. And Kevin Landrigan, what's the next step for either of these bills, relatively speaking? What's happening with them?
Yeah, well, I think now they go into the committee process, and I think at the end of the hearing, Senator Carson, who chaired the hearing as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, she said she thinks that a common ground can be reached to encompass all of these things, that that there can be some kind of compromise. Meanwhile, this isn't the end of the story, meaning this is not the last issue with regard to police transparency. Remember, I spoke of this independent review panel that what the governor really wants, that would create these hearings for all police misconduct. Attorney General Gordon McDonnell came up with a 23-member review panel during the commission's deliberations last summer and early fall. And the commission decided to junk it in their recommendations, meaning the commission supported a review panel, but left it up to the legislature to decide who should be on it. I talked to people afterwards, and it turned out folks supportive of ACLU, Black Lives Matter, said too many police people on the Attorney General's review panel. I talked to police, they said too many opponents of police on the review panel. So now legislators, interest groups are now still negotiating on what that review panel legislation should look for. So that's the next big theater in this fight in 2021.
We're going to talk about a few more things related to legislation. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Of course, the news this morning is that as of 8 o'clock this morning, Friday morning, people age 65 and older can now attempt to sign up for COVID-19 vaccines using the state's dedicated website, which is vaccines.nh.gov. If you prefer to not use a computer, you can always call 211 and make your appointment that way. Governor Sununu said the state is bringing on 300 additional employees to answer that hotline, but wait times could still be long. We're hearing of some people having problems with vaccines.nh.gov, and while we're not going to talk about that on the program right now, we'd love to hear about your experience with it so far. Send us an email. That's the best way to reach us and have your voice heard. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Anna, the Election Law Committee took up some bills addressing voting, particularly absentee ballots this week. So, Anna, the 2020 presidential election saw a major expansion of this form of voting. The state seems to have reported that things went fairly well. To what extent has this experience with absentee voting informed some of the bills under consideration now?
So yesterday and today and next week, there's going to be hearings on the issue of absentee voting. In general, there are even more bills coming down the pipeline, and they go in all directions. So first of all, I just want to reiterate, as you said, that Governor Sununu, Secretary of State Bill Gardner, New Hampshire election officials across the state have all affirmed that there was not any widespread voter fraud or anything like that. Absentee balloting in New Hampshire was very secure. And so I think that that's important to note. However, this takes place across a national backdrop, as you know, of course, of many people being very suspicious of the absentee balloting process in one way or another. And so these bills reflect that. On the one hand, you have Democrats sponsoring bills that would make this expanded eligibility, so no excuse absentee voting, anybody can vote absentee. They want to make that permanent because it was just for 2020 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other end of the spectrum, sure, you have Republicans who want to restrict it in various states, add more identification requirements or more verification procedures.
And so this is a strictly a party line kind of vote or argument, Anna Brown?
What I am seeing at this point is that mostly, yes, mostly you're seeing Democrats saying, let's expand this. It worked well. It was Governor Sununu himself said the 2020 election was secure. This is a voter access issue. And then on the other hand, Republicans say, there, we absolutely need to secure and verify these ballots. Just, we need to protect the sanctity of our elections. However, there is one bill that I find kind of walks that middle road again, which is going to have a hearing today at 10 a.m. So that's SB2. And it's going to sort of extend the early processing of absentee ballots and some of that other stuff just for town meetings, really. And that's also a bill that would postpone annual town meetings if towns so choose, so that they could do it later in the year when they can maybe do it outside. So that bill, I would say, is an exception. But otherwise, it does seem to mostly fall on party lines.
And Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, what are you hearing with respect to bills about not just absentee voting, but any other kind of voting legislation?
Well, certainly another issue, Anna gave a great summary, as always, about the status of things. But another side issue that's actually one of the, it's high on the to-do list of this legislature, is redistricting. Every 10 years, this legislature has to redistrict to adjust for the changes in population due to the census, the voting districts for the House, the Senate, the Executive Council, and the two seats in the U.S. Congress. Their legislation is back again to change that process, bipartisan legislation, to create an independent redistricting commission, not to take it out of the hands of the legislature. The legislature would still have the last say, but this commission would be in charge of all the groundwork and all the examination and all the initial recommendations about how to change these districts. That legislation has been vetoed in the past 2 years by Republican Governor Chris Sununu. And I think there'll be a major effort to try and revive that legislation this year, but it's the wrong year to do it. And why do I say that? Because Republicans now control the House. As we know, for the fifth time in the last six elections, political control in New Hampshire House of Representatives has flipped from one party to another. So Republicans now control the House, and they now control the state Senate, and they're not about to give away power as they have this lucky bounce, right? They've won this election when every 10 years you get to redistrict your voting boundaries. So this legislation really has a steeper uphill climb this year than it would in any other year, and that's why.
Well, thank you for those insights. We've got more to talk about when it comes to the State House after a quick break. Coming up, Speaker Sherm Packard is taking criticism from Democrats who say he's dealing out punishments unfairly. A Democratic lawmaker was stripped of her committee assignment for criticizing the chief of police in Troy, New Hampshire, who attended the rally in D.C. on January 6th that resulted in some pro-Trump extremists storming the U.S. Capitol. But two Republican lawmakers accused of anti-Semitic social media posts have not received any kind of official backlash. So we'll look at the details and we'll take your take on this as well. What do you think? Is this partisan retribution, or is House Speaker Sherm Packard right? Let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you for tuning in. We're catching up on a busy week of news today with our guests, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization promoting civic engagement, and Kevin Landrigan, State House Bureau Chief for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to talk about Representative Rosemary Rung, who lost her committee assignment when House Speaker Sherm Packard objected to her social media post about the police chief of Troy, New Hampshire, who attended the rally in D.C. where some pro-Trump extremists stormed the U.S. Capitol. What do you think of Rung's comments? Should she have lost her assignment? Email exchange at nhpr.org or give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. But first, I want to talk about Gordon McDonald, Attorney General of New Hampshire, who has been nominated once again to the state Supreme Court. The first time when he was nominated, the Executive Council's majority Democrats voted down the nomination, but this time Republicans have the majority. And yesterday, McDonald attended a hearing on his nomination. Kevin Landrigan, what kind of questions did Gordon McDonald field yesterday?
Yeah, you know, what was really interesting about this, Peter, was he received many of the same questions he got 2 years ago and criticisms of him 2 years ago. One, that he's been a Republican activist before he was a attorney general. He was a legal counsel to the Republican State Committee. He worked as a staffer for former conservative U.S. Senator Gordon Humphrey, and worked on Republican presidential campaigns. Other criticisms were that this is the third person Governor Chris Sununu has nominated to the Supreme Court, and he's the third person to have no judicial experience before he's put on the state's highest court. The other criticism in the past has been that he's never led a jury trial from start to finish. But what was interesting about this hearing, which lasted more than 4 hours, was 2 years later, a funny thing happened on the way to the second nomination of Gordon McDonald, and that is COVID-19. So that a good part of this hearing was dominated by critics of Attorney General McDonald's defense of Chris Sununu's orders with regard to imposing restrictions since the pandemic, including levying fines against businesses, mm-hmm. as well as the mask mandate that New Hampshire has. So he was called upon to defend those decisions and defend that this governor had a constitutional and legal right to not only declare the emergency, but extend the emergency 15 times now, and also impose a whole lot of restrictions. At the end of the day, that's probably a good bounce for this attorney general. And the reason is, as we know, this governor's very popular, partly as a result of his performance since the pandemic. And his handling of the pandemic has polled extremely well across all parties. So to have the attorney general criticized for this is a lot easier for him to defend than his, you know, vociferous support for the anti-abortion activists as a private attorney.
Yeah, regarding anti-abortion feelings among the attorney general, McDonald says his personal feelings are left at the door. With respect to leaving personal feelings at the door, Anna Brown, what do you think? What do you make of the attorney general's comments?
I think that those comments are very much in line with what many, I would hope, most if not all judicial nominees are going to commit to, because realistically, we know that everyone goes in with certain perspectives, but the whole idea of the judiciary is that you rule based on the facts of the law, the facts of the case, and the Constitution. So I feel like I think he did a good job in terms of, well, let's be real, he had a couple of years to prepare, I suppose, but I think he did a very good job in terms of sticking to lines that honestly even go back to Ruth Bader Ginsburg in terms of, I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to rule on future hypothetical cases because we need to see the facts of the case in front of us. And if Roe v. Wade does get repealed, well, yeah, you know, we're going to have to look at the facts of the case in front of us. So I think that he does seem to be very cool, calm, and collected in that way. I think it will. I suppose it's fair to say that Executive Counselor Cindy Warmington probably had a more difficult job than Democrats did a couple of years ago because she is at this point the only remaining Democrat on the council. And so she did a long section of questioning that I think, you know, she kind of had to carry that part of it. So, you know, I guess hats off to her in terms of, you know, you had to go against it. But then again, he did also have those new opponents from the right, as Kevin Landrigan was talking about in terms of these COVID-19 restrictions. So obviously, I think he's likely to be confirmed. And I think, you know, ideally, he is going to be, you know, the judicial administrator, and he's going to focus on the facts of the case and the facts of the law. But We've seen with Supreme Court appointments at the federal level that you often don't really know what you're going to get until they are seated. You know, I think that Justice John Roberts, for example, was seated under President Bush and has turned out to be much more moderate than many some people expected. So it'll be interesting to see.
I can't remember which president said it, but one president said that once you appoint them to the Supreme Court, they cease to be your friend.
Well, I certainly know former President Trump definitely expressed that feeling as well.
Perhaps always true, perhaps only sometimes, who knows. But let's talk about another story that made headlines this week. Kevin Landrigan, you wrote this week that the Union Leader that a Merrimack Democrat is protesting the loss of her House committee assignment after she called on social media for the resignation of Troy's police chief, who attended the Washington rally before the insurrection on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. We should note that the police chief there has said that he did not take part in the violence and that he has since disavowed the mob that stormed the Capitol. But Kevin Landrigan, take us through what happened with the Representative Rosemary Rung.
Yeah, as you pointed out, Rosemary Rung, the only Democrat standing in the town of Merrimack, who held on to her seat, sent out a tweet after the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, criticizing Troy Police Chief David Ellis for attending a rally before the uprising. There's no evidence that, and the chief had denied he was anywhere near the Capitol after that rally, but rather he was at the rally. And in part of her tweet reads, in part, all New Hampshire police need to denounce Ellis and call on his resignation. He was there to violate the U.S. Constitution. He did not step in to stop the attack as an off-duty officer, but watched as many police officers were injured. He's a stain on each and every New Hampshire police officer who does not come out against him.
And the argument there is that Sherman Packard thinks that that incited some kind of violence or created a risky situation in the town of Troy.
As it happened, as you know, when you folks reported, as did we, there were some threats against the town that caused Town Hall for a period of time to be shut down in response to some of those anonymous threats that came in against the town and against the chief. And so that was the new speaker's reasoning for removing her from her committee assignment. Now, Rosemary Rung and others, supporters of hers, essentially say this is hypocritical, since two Republican members of the House, Don Johnson of Laconia and James Blaine of Deerfield, have both been criticized for making posts online that were seen as anti-Semitic. And no punishment has been levied against them. So, by the way, Speaker Packard has indicated, one, Don Johnson has repeatedly apologized for those posts and has been kind of censured by her own school board in town for those posts. And James, and Packard said he didn't consider what the cartoon that James Blaine to have posted to have been anti-Semitic. It's also important to point out, Packard has already informed Representative Rung last week that this may not be permanent. He wrote her, quote, if you can demonstrate to me in a sincere manner, you regret the tone and the subject matter of your social media posts, and you realize how it could have contributed to the very serious situation the town of Troy and its public officials are experiencing, I'll be happy to consider your request.
So she must apologize first in order to be considered for reinstatement on that committee.
Exactly.
Let's talk to Anita in Newmarket, who's calling on this. Anita, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I was interested to hear the longer excerpts of what Speaker Packard said and in his disciplinary, but also about what the Merrimack legislator said. I think Sherman Packard's actions were overreactions, and not allowing the representative from Merrimack to express reasonable concern about the police chief in Troy's participation in the events of 2 weeks ago.
Well, Anita, thank you very much for your comments. This is, of course, a developing story that we're going to stay with here at NHPR. We have to move on to a few other topics, notably COVID-19, seemingly going to be the biggest story of 2021 as it was in 2020. But I want to thank our guests for being on the program today. Kevin Landrigan, State House Bureau Chief for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count. Thank you very much, both of you, for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Have a great weekend. Peter.
Take care.
And let's turn now to Nora Doyle Burr. She's a reporter with the Valley News and has been following how the governments of both New Hampshire and Vermont have been handling COVID-19. Nora, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Peter. Thanks for having me.
So always helpful to have a state-by-state comparison, but let's focus on New Hampshire first, because yesterday, Governor Sununu and state public health officials announced 925 new COVID-19 cases, a dozen new deaths, and public health officials emphasized a few developments they see as hopeful, which is the number of people hospitalized is down from last week, test positivity rate is slightly down, and of the 65 people who died in the past week, just over half of those were associated with long-term care. representing a decline in the percentage of deaths. State epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan said that's an indication that, hey, these vaccination efforts might be starting to make an impact in the numbers. But what do these numbers say to you, Nora?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, certainly encouraging to see those trends, but also, you know, 925 is a big number, as are a dozen deaths, you know, in a day.
Yeah. And so what are we seeing between Vermont and New Hampshire? Is Vermont seeing something similar happening?
Yeah, I mean, so Vermont has had, you know, lower numbers throughout the pandemic, but has seen, you know, a Christmas related surge in cases that officials are hoping is starting to also turn the corner.
So holiday activity, in short, is prompting the same kind of spikes in Vermont as it did in New Hampshire. Okay.
Yeah.
What about nursing homes? I mean, what kind of outbreaks are you seeing in nursing homes in your coverage area in particular?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think we're also seeing right now, I think I'm tracking about 5 or 6 outbreaks in senior living facilities in between the two states. So, you know, we've seen deaths related to those. Perhaps, you know, in terms of what Dr. Chan said yesterday, we have not seen as many deaths, at least thus far, with the more recent outbreaks. But I guess we'll see moving forward.
We've got a call from Margarita in Portsmouth. Thank you very much for calling, Margarita. You're on the air.
First of all, thank you for yet another interesting morning with you. I'm calling for an alert. I'm 84 years old. I followed all the rules this morning to get my vaccine registered. Got to the outline online, filled the entire outline out, and came upon the fact that because I have a 914 telephone area code, I have been rejected by the state. Now, my 914 area code I've carried for 20 years. I have New York written on my heart. But I actually lived in Portsmouth for 6 years, as my doctors can attest. So I thought I would alert old people, particularly, that you have to be more assertive if you have an area code outside of New Hampshire. And there are no phones that are being answered, of course, so I can't correct it. I thought this might be the only way I could let that information out.
Margarita, you've tried 211 and you can't get through?
I got 211, and they're the ones who fielded me the form, which, by the way, is very easy and clear to fill out. Perfectly easy and clear to fill out, which I did. And I went beyond, you know, when you come to your phone number, I put mine in and it said, red line, you're not accepted. But I said, well, maybe I'll fill out the whole rest of it and it'll excuse me. But I filled out the whole rest of it and it won't accept my application.
Well, Margarita, thank you very much for your insights. Really appreciate it. Listeners, by the way, Margarita is referring to the website that went live this morning, vaccines.nh.gov, which allows people in phase 1B of the vaccination groups to start scheduling appointments. Those appointments won't start until next week. But Nora Doyle Burr, the governor, Governor Sununu, outlined some expectations for this website yesterday. Can you tell us a little bit about what he was hoping to accomplish with this registration website?
Sure. You know, I mean, I guess my understanding is that folks over the age of 65 in New Hampshire, and also people under the age of 65 with two or more of a certain list of medical conditions, are supposed to be able to register online, you know, starting this morning. And then they'll get an email, I guess, so that they can schedule the appointment down the road sometime.
Okay. Well, we're going to stay on top of this story as it evolves. But overall, Nora, what are you seeing as far as any new restrictions, either in Vermont or New Hampshire, that listeners should be aware of with respect to COVID-19? Is there anything new that's been incorporated recently, or is it still the same, you know, mask up, social distance, avoid crowds kind of guidance?
Right. Yes. No, I am not aware of new restrictions in either state.
Mm-hmm. Nora Doyle Burr, we thank you very much for your time, reporter with the Valley News. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Just want to bring you up to speed on some headlines that NHPR has been following throughout the week. New Hampshire's unemployment rate for December was 4%, which is a slight increase from November. The number still reflects the impact of the pandemic. The number of unemployed residents increased by 360 over the month to 29,920. This was 10,000 more unemployed than in December of 2019. Also, the majority of inmates who tested positive for COVID-19 at Valley Street Jail in Manchester are considered recovered. 32 inmates at the jail were still positive, and the state continues to test inmates and staff on a weekly basis. So far, Valley Street has had the largest coronavirus outbreak of any county jail in the state, with dozens of staff and 108 inmates testing positive since the beginning of December. Judges have allowed some inmates there to be released on bail, citing concerns about medical care and COVID-19 conditions in the facility. And that's it for this week. But remember, you can find all of the stories that we have discussed on our website, nhpr.org. And we're always looking forward to hearing from you about issues that are important to you. And you can send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Or why not tweet us? You can find us on Twitter @NHPRExchange. You can find me on Twitter @PeterBiello. I really appreciate you tuning in today. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show is produced by senior producer Ellen Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips produce the show as well, as does Jane Vaughn. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.